So it's my total and complete pleasure to introduce Clay. I'll be very, very brief. Most of us are familiar with Clay and his sort of habit of doing groundbreaking work. Well, it's true.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Damn it. Also, just a really good writer and wonderful speaker. His new book is Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. And Clay, you're going to talk about an aspect of a topic in the book, but and then talk about the book at the later 6 o'clock.
Yes, right. In fact, and I should say, I'm Clay Shirky. I teach at the Interactive Telecommunications Program down at NYU, where I work on social software. I work on software that supports group interactions in various ways. And when we were talking about coming up and doing a book talk, David said, would you be interested in coming by and doing having a more conversational talk about some of the themes in the book? And I said yes, and I didn't know at the time, but now feel it enormously, that I'm the book is just available on Amazon today, and I'm already saying exactly the same things over and over again to media involved. So when David, one of the things I learned about writing a book is that you can't use compression as an argument for why you didn't talk about certain things, because you have all the space you need. And so when you bump up against something where you don't really know what to think yet, it's a much more disconcerting feeling in a book than it is in an essay, because you then kind of have to cop to, well, I don't really know where this is going. So I thought, I'm going to pick one of those things and talk about it. Basically, one of the themes that I saw in a lot of examples of the book, but don't have any resolution in it, and then we can talk about it here. So one of the themes that came out in sort of collating these stories and trying to derive the underlying driving forces behind them was this question of protest culture, right? Because one of the things that happens when you allow groups to come together and to accomplish things together that they were previously locked out of doing is that a lot of times what you get is that group's grievances. Right, you get the things that they don't think are going well, and they're pressing for their case. So I want to tell four quick stories about protest culture that are derived from here that struck me as being emblematic of something, but I'm not quite sure what. I'm going to offer up a framework for it, and then to conversation. So one of the easiest to see examples of this new group forming equals new kinds of protest got started in late 99, or actually in early 1999, when with a Northwest Airlines flight that was diverted first to Miami on its way home from the Caribbean, and then the next day flew up to Detroit. And they landed in Detroit at around 2:45, only to discover that Detroit was completely snowbound. The gates, you couldn't get to a gate, right? And so there they are, stuck on the tarmac, hour after hour. They run out of food, then they run out of water. The toilets start to smell, then leak, then break. The babies are crying. It's 20 degrees below wind chill outside. And they landed at 2:45 in the afternoon. They got off the plane at 9:30 that night. So they were stuck with their fellow man for 7.5 hours in a smelly tube. It was not a pleasant experience. And the media, needless to say, went berserk for this story, right? It was clear that the situation was intolerable. Something needed to be done. And then nothing happened. Nothing at all. Northwest just waited it out. There was a class action lawsuit. Lawyers had been running up and down the aisle sort of canvassing for names. They settled the class action lawsuit out of court. They said, oh, we're signing up for this voluntary toothless code of conduct, and the entire thing blew over. And year after year, from 99, anytime there was an attempt to argue for passengers' rights in this situation of being delayed on the tarmac for hours, they would point to this toothless code of conduct and say, no, we got it all figured out. So then, about a year ago Christmas, it happens again, this time flights diverted from American Airlines diverted to Dallas. 8 hours on the tarmac this time. Same thing. Run out of food, run out of water, toilets break, and then leak, and then shut down. Different babies, same crying, but just an equally horrific situation. Kate Hanna, a Napa Valley real estate agent, gets off the plane pissed. And I think, like a lot of people on the Northwest flight, she vows to do something. But what she does is she sits around Googling all of the traditional media outlets' stories. And anytime anyone writes about this, she finds that story, and she goes and adds her own commentary at the end. Her comments are often longer than the original article, saying, I was on this flight, this is what happened to me. And at the end of her comment, she says, if anybody reading this was on this flight, contact me. So she takes the platform for information distribution and she turns it into a tool of coordination. And lo and behold, people come in and say, I was on that flight. I actually collected email addresses from a bunch of my neighbors. And within a few days, you can still find her trail now when you Google this stuff. Within days, she'd use the mainstream media stories to actually call together a group of a dozen or so people. And they called themselves the Coalition for the Passengers' Bill of Rights. They put up a weblog. On the weblog, they have a little button, click here to sign the petition, tens of thousands of signatures in a few weeks. And in 8 months, right, they get the New York State Legislature to pass a Passengers' Bill of Rights. And since New York's the busiest airspace in the country, it's basically a national policy. So that went into effect January 1st. The airlines didn't know what hit them, right? Because after fighting this thing off year after year for 8 years, suddenly this little group, out of nowhere, no budget, no staff, suddenly creates this leverage, and they create it not by doing something like a class action lawsuit, not by proxying the traditional oppositional system, but really by organizing the previously disorganized passengers, right? And that shift in media from a source of information to being a site of coordination, right? Her original attempt to use the mainstream media outlets as a way of gathering the people who were interested in the story was the thing that gave her this leverage, right? The difference between 99 and 2006 wasn't a difference in tools. There was no new thing that had been deployed that she was able to use, right? This is a story about weblogs and wikis and email and so forth. What was different is that everybody had those tools, right? This is actually a change in audience density rather than technological capability. But when you're looking at group action, the change in audience density is actually a really big change. There's another two-slide comparison, which is actually quite interesting to tell in Boston, which was the John Gagan trial in 2002, the Catholic priest abuse scandal, right? Where January of that year, John Gagan is being brought to trial for having abused, I think, 130 boys, now men, but at the time boys, 130 boys came forward. The Boston Globe does this enormous two-part story. The Archbishop at the time, Law, is then fighting with the media in public about how much criticism the Catholic Church should come in for. And in the middle of all of this, in this little church basement in Wellesley, 30 people get together, and they basically say, we got to do something, right? And there was really not much more to the meeting than that. Just this sense of, we're angry, we're upset, this organization we care about has betrayed us, we have to do something. And so they called themselves, by the end of that evening, Voice of the Faithful, and they launched this organization. By that summer, by June, they had 25,000 members in 21 countries, right? Organizations don't grow that fast, or they didn't used to until the internet came along. And the Catholic Church's response to Voice of the Faithful was, I think not surprisingly, one of abject horror, right? In fact, they changed the clerical directive to say lay organizations can use parish property, but they may not coordinate across parish lines. If you are a parishioner in the Catholic Church, you cannot talk to other Catholics not in your diocese. I mean, not in your diocese, not in your parish, not in the smallest unit. So they were explicitly trying to extend the hierarchy to include the laity, right? Because they'd never had to make that argument before, right? It was the moment where they realized if they have lateral organization, our hierarchical subdivision stops working above the level of the pew, and we'll be in real trouble. Because their strategy for pedophile priests had been, when the action got too hot, settle with some local families,
in return for bought silence, move the priest and start it all over again, which is how Gagin got his hands on 130 boys. So you look at 2002, right, which, I mean, I think just yesterday, the Catholic diocese in Massachusetts, is Eastern Massachusetts, announced it was having to sell off several properties to deal with the scandal. So you look at 2002 and you think, well, you know, this was really the breakthrough moment, right? Some major thing came to light, strong press coverage, and there was a great interest on the part of the Catholic community. But then you play the tape back to 92, and the entire thing happened almost exactly the same way. This time the priest's name was Porter. It was 99 boys instead of 130, but it was certainly the same, you know, the same rough order of magnitude. The Globe covered it. Law complained about it. It was in the same diocese, but it blew over in 92, right? So what happened between 92 and 2002? Same questions with the airlines, right? One of the things that happened is that in 92, the Globe wasn't global, right? The Globe was, in fact, an entirely local paper. If they published something, it didn't get outside the bounds of Eastern Massachusetts. In 2002, when they published this story, it generated so much traffic, just the story on priestly abuse, generated so much global traffic that the New York Times Company put it in its shareholder report talking about change in audience size, right? So that story, the effect of super distribution, right, and the re-forwarding in that story suddenly made the audience for a story larger than the audience for the media outlet as a whole, which is a total inversion of anything we're used to in thinking about traditional media. The other thing that happened, of course, is that Voice of the Faithful is a very Google-friendly phrase, which means that right by 2002, we've witnessed the death of the URL. And once anybody mentions Voice of the Faithful, you're one search away from being able to get there. You're one click away from being able to join, to donate, and so forth. So again, this is a case where media is not only global in its outbound spread, but now has become a site of coordination. Here's the interesting PS to the Voice of the Faithful story. They're now in their sixth year, right? They've just, in fact, passed their sixth anniversary as of last month. And they're really suffering. Because after the original success, they forced Law to resign. They cut off donations to the diocese until they promised to alter how they managed the affairs of accused priests and so forth. But now they have this problem of they were born of this incredible single issue energy, and they've now gotten to the point where they have to institutionalize. And the threat to them is, should we just have made that our issue, taken it on, done what we've done, and now dissolve? Or should we double down and institutionalize? And in the course of institutionalizing, many of their more radical elements who want to take on the Catholic Church in very muscular ways around other kinds of issues are now coming to the fore. So there's a real tension in this bit of protest culture between long-term between short-term and long-term engagement. Third story, Jericho, the science fiction show, gets canceled. This one was in all the papers. And the fans get upset, right? So there's a big history of fan protests. But the fans by this point have twigged to the fact that email is highly deletable, as we all know. So they're going around saying, don't bother mailing the executives at CBS, right? They're not going to pay any attention. We've got to think of something else to do. So the last line in the show in the previous season was nuts, which was basically a response to a request to surrender of this town of Jericho, Kansas. Nuts also being the response to the American side at the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge. So they decide, we're going to send nuts to CBS, right? So they go and they buy a bunch of peanuts, and they get the address of the CBS loading dock over in Burbank. And they send them 20 tons of peanuts in their shells, right? Now, the CBS loading dock in Burbank, it's optimized for acceptance of Betamax, right? Like a little box, the little tape in it. They're not optimized for 20 tons of peanuts, and you can't delete peanuts, right? So there's a picture of the guy on the CBS loading dock with bales of peanuts over his head, right? So this works, right? CBS finally sees, right, that they've relented. CBS relents and reruns the show. The interesting thing to me about the Jericho example is it is, in a way, a repudiation of the kind of move-on model of political engagement, because email is actually now too good. Email is too easy to send. Right. In the old days, if you got a letter on a piece of paper from a constituent who'd found your address and a stamp and an envelope and walked to the corner or driven to the mall and mailed it, 2,000 votes, right? If that amount of effort correlated to about 2,000 votes in your district. So I asked Danny O'Brien, who does this stuff for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, right? What's a piece of email worth now? And he said, nothing, zero, right? It's discounted to nothing because it's too easy. And because the AstroTurf campaigns have so successfully gotten people to write in to senators and representatives who don't represent them, right? They're not voters in their district. That on the Hill, email has now been discounted to nothing because, A, it's too easy to send, and, B, there's no way to sort for the people who have actually voted for you. So one of the surprises in the Jericho protest is they managed to find something that was actually much higher cost than email. Because however easy it is to go to Nuts Online and fill out the form and whatever, you still have to pay some money, right? These were people who were paying to send a message. And now it isn't the cost of the media anymore. It's the cost of the thing that travels with the media, in this case, the peanuts, that serves as this kind of high-cost signaling. And then last example, the one I think in the book that I found most inspiring. You remember flash mobs, right? The flagpole sitting of 2003. Well, flash mobs were promulgated by Bill from New York, right? Who was the sender of these emails, right? Let's all synchronize watches, and then 100 people will show up and sit on a stone ledge in Central Park and all make pigeon noises, right? And, you know, people would do this, or they would all go to Macy's and all pretend to be shopping for a love rug for their commune all at the same time. And it turned out that one of the things Bill from New York was doing, he was using flash mobs as political commentary. And he was saying, essentially, hipsters are so malleable and brain dead that if you tell them that what they're doing is going to be shocking to the bourgeoisie, they will completely set aside any kind of judgment they have and do any damn fool thing you write down in a piece of email. And lo and behold, they did, right? You have a zombie walk in San Francisco and a pillow fight in Toronto and, you know. So this thing spreads around. By 2006, it gets to Belarus. Somebody puts up a LiveJournal page. Says, hey, you guys, I know, let's have a flash mob at downtown Minsk, right? Let's all walk around October Square eating ice cream, right? It's what passes for a good time in Minsk, I guess. So they then upload these photos. And there's these kids walking around Minsk all eating ice cream. And then the next in the series of photos are black-clad secret police dragging those kids bodily out of the square. Because the problem with the group eating the ice cream wasn't the ice cream. It was the group. It's illegal to act in concert in October Square. Lukashenko, the leader of Belarus, stole the election in 2006, and in order to forestall Leipzig-like public protests in the main square, he simply made it illegal to be in a group in the square. So these kids took this tool, which was meant as a kind of commentary on apolitical Western society. And they've turned it into a political tool in the Belarusian context. They forced the state to react in real time, right? And they've done it in a way that the state can't interdict, right? You can't stop the conspiracy because there's no conspiracy. It's done on a weblog, right? How much more public could it be? And you can't stop the group from entering October Square, because when they enter October Square, it's not a group, right? The whole point of flash mobs. So something that in a Western context, or in a Western industrialized context, is actually a really fairly trivial kind of exercise, in a low-freedom environment like Belarus, has been repurposed to be this really interesting political tool. My favorite, they've done several of these. My favorite was, let's all go to downtown Minsk and walk around October Square smiling at each other, right? Well, damn it, there's an ontological dilemma for the cops, right? I mean, are you, yes, citizen, are you smiling because you're a member of the conspiracy? And the other great sort of asterisk is, anybody walking around Minsk smiling is probably imagining Lukashenko's overthrow. So, I mean, really, kind of horribly, the bug in this system, right? The kids didn't just do this to provoke this reaction; they also did it to document it. Right? They didn't just bring their ice cream to the square. They brought their cameras, and they get these pictures up online quick. And so it's not just media creates collective action. They're also having collective action create more media. The bug in the system is they believe the West still cares about dictatorship in Eastern Europe. And they don't understand that in the current geopolitical context, the evidence of this kind of abuse just resonates a lot less than it used to. So, of all the groups where I thought, I'm just going to track this just to see what happens because I hope a good thing happens, it's those Belarusian kids. So here's the conundrum. Those are a bunch of different stories about protest movements that have had some effect, with the exception of Move On, which I think has been largely under-optimized in its effect. And it seems to me that a commonality among those and some others in the book is they're hard to fake non-professional surprises, right? If I had to put a label on what I'm seeing, hard to fake meaning someone's taking on real cost or difficulty, or enough people are signing on that you couldn't just astroturf this, right? So in the case of Kate Hanna and the air passengers, right, it was just tens of thousands of signatures, right? It got to the point where if she walked into a legislator's office, it was a fair bet that some of their constituents had signed on to this participation, right? Hard to fake is certainly showing up in October Square, standing up to be counted. Hard to fake is sending peanuts because you've had some kind of expense. But something that gets around the total ease of communication and recreates in the mind of the people being protested against the idea that there is some legitimacy. Non-professional is really the sense that there is not, this isn't now an institution-to-institution clash, right? One of the classic, the airline industry would have paid Kate Hanna almost any amount of money not to have that legislation go. Right. The last time they settled out of court for millions of dollars for a single flight rather than have the idea of a passenger's bill of rights be enshrined in law. But Kate Hanna and her group had no second demand. Right. There was no horse trading to be done because it wasn't like they had a big organization and a long list of things they were working for. They were single issue. To capitulate on that issue was to go out of existence. And that non-professional characteristic was also what made Voice of the Faithful work in the early days, because it was impossible to write them off, although many people tried. It was impossible to write them off as essentially professional dissidents, right? Long-term dissidents. And then the surprises thing, right? That effectively the protein coat of protests is mutating much faster right now. And it is those protests that the target doesn't recognize or know what to do with that seem to me to be working. So the upsides of this, right, there's a reversal of scale, right? We're used to a world where small, highly coordinated special interests beat out large distributed groups who care. You know, a lot of people care a little bit about being treated better by the airlines, but the airlines care a lot about not having to treat us better, right? So one of the obvious upsides is just being able to coordinate large groups gives us this potential reversal of scale. Going alongside that is less of an imbalance of engagement, right? That by lowering, by making it easier for more people to participate, you change the calculus of trying to get people excited about improving their lives in some way or other. In particular, to the Kate Hanna example, the usual model for political engagement is for the people who really, really care about an issue to go around trying to get everybody else really worked up about it. And then those people's targets mostly say, God, why don't those people shut up for a minute, right? They're so hyperactive about this one issue. What's happening now is that actually caring just a little bit is actually enough to participate. So instead of raising the excitement of the people you want to work with, you're lowering some of the hurdles. The conundrum here is how do you lower those hurdles to participation while still preserving this hard-to-fake characteristic? That's one of the reasons I think that having those people then pay money to participate is turning out to be an easy to do but hard to fake signal. And then the third thing that's quite interesting is there's more targets, right? Which is to say, it's a better fit for our actual lives, which are affected not just by government action, but by corporate action, and in some cases by religious action, right? That for all the protesting against the government that has gone on in this country for the last 40 years, there have been many fewer commercial and almost no anti-religious protests, right? Voice of the Faithful is really unusual in its being a political protest against a non-political target. Here's the downsides, and this is I think then the thing that I want to end with and then talk about, because this is the stuff that's worrying me. So working backwards on hard to fake non-professional surprise is a wasting asset, right? What that says is once you get a strategy perfected, it may not work as well, which means we may be in the long haul in a set of battles that actually favor the people who can wait out the surprises, right? That there's some evidence, in fact, just in the relatively trivial world of protests about closures of television shows, that the success of Jericho actually created a set of antibodies where television executives are now less responsive to those kind of campaigns because they understand this kind of targeting now. Whether or not that's a great loss to society, I don't know, but it is an example of an arms race where if your principal weapon is surprise, then you have a very hard time coming up with replicable strategies. Second possible downside, lack of institutional counterweight, right? The Catholic Church is an ancient institution. And if the Voice of the Faithful's success in changing their position vis-a-vis pedophile priests was a one-off, and then now they're going to dissolve and just have latent capability, it may be that only the most egregious abuses get addressed, because there is no institution on the other side of the aisle watching out persistently for abuse or backsliding. Here's my nightmare. Print is still shrinking. It will continue to shrink. And the places that are going to get it in the neck are not, in fact, the Washington Post and the New York Times, as badly as they are doing. It's going to be the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, right? And I forget the name of the New Orleans paper. In any case, the Times-Picayune. If investigative journalism goes away in every city of 500,000 or less, institutional corruption may come back in through the door it was forced to exit when we got good investigative reporting in those cities starting in the 1950s. Right? Investigative journalism seems to me to be almost canonically one of the things that requires institutional support. I like social software as much as the next guy, as you might expect, but I'm not convinced that an active blogging community has the same effect as a beat reporter going down to City Hall again today to look for the thing that they have a hunch about that may never appear. So the lack of institutional counterweight, as fantastic as it is in many cases to see these kind of like, this little group came out of nowhere and they self-organized and they protested and they made a good thing happen. There's a bunch of situations where a good thing happening isn't enough. And I don't know what institutional counterweight looks like, or if I'm looking in the wrong place. Maybe there are other ways to get that kind of effect. And finally, and I told the Jericho story in part because of this, human emotion turns out to be a really lousy filter for political importance, right? The kinds of things that people are really willing to get worked up about, the very first story in the book, in fact, is about that woman who lost her cell phone in the back of the cab in New York City, got picked up by a 16-year-old in Queens, who was then using it to send pictures around and upload them to MySpace, so that when the original owner of the phone got the phone back, they had her email address, they had her MySpace account, they had pictures of her and her boyfriend and her baby, and they posted it all online. And a million people tuned in to see whether this woman got her phone back, including helping browbeat the New York City Police Department into finally going out and arresting this 16-year-old unwed mother who just happened to have found the wrong phone in the back of a cab. the amount of attention that went into the recovery of that phone on the part of, you know, on behalf of people who could well afford another $300 phone. It was certainly too bad that she lost her phone. But what happened to the recipient of the phone may be much worse. And so the kinds of things that it's the same as when you go to the front page of a newspaper and you looked at the most read stories and then you look at the most forwarded stories, right? The things we do in a social context, if you want someone to forward a story, put a puppy in it, right? If you want someone to read it, put something about Abu Ghraib in it. People don't forward Abu Ghraib stories by and large. They forward puppy stories. And so if we're giving over protest culture to these kinds of shorter-term emotional triggers, we may also get a lighter-weight protest culture. So, I'm talking about this precisely because I didn't come up with a coherent framework or answer in the book, but that's essentially where I am now thinking about protest culture. So with that, I'll end.
Very, very, very provocative and well-spoken. And I think I very much enjoyed your examples, and I think they exemplify these. We're good exemplars.
And so when you talk about these large groups, and I heard you give another talk about sort of parallels, and I remember the talk that you gave at the, it was in the fall, and what you were saying, that there are a small group of people. You may start big, but then you end up with a small group of people if you have persistence. And so do you think, and I must say, I also concur with you that you're going to need persistent institutions. That, I mean, if you're confusing sort of fads and emotions with genuine, and I think your example of Belarus is a wonderful example, because that's a different situation. That there's real costs associated with that. I mean, it has some of the similar aspects. Then do you see new kind of emergent institutions? I mean, if it's not going to be within the traditional one, and what would be the properties of those? And do you see the return of a small group in some sense?
Yeah.
And then how do you legitimate that group? And how does that done in a Web 3.0 way? And then how does the media sort of reinvent itself along that dimension? Because I think you're going to have to. I mean, it's nice to have the reporter, the journalist there doing, but it's going to be something different.
Yeah. I mean, to take.
Sorry. Okay. No. I'm sure you're good.
To take the last question first. I think the reinvention of media is really around this recognition that every URL is a latent community, right? That every URL, whatever else it does, it gathers the attention of people who might have enough shared interest that adding some coordination to what they're doing creates a kind of potential value. Now, to the 90th percentile, that's unused, right? Everybody looking at the front page of Google right now has almost nothing in common, right? I need a fiberglass hull for my boat, right? And you need a way to get, you need to download a term paper, right? But when you're looking at very specific kinds of, everybody looking at the photo of these kids in Belarus, for instance, the group that has assembled around that media might be able to help in ways that media doesn't even currently recognize, much less take advantage of. Kate Hanna basically invented this for herself by using the comments of the newspaper section, yeah, which are mainly a write-only dumping ground. Oh, I agree, I disagree. She used it as a coordinating tool, which strikes me as the single most imaginative thing she did.
Well, it wouldn't have happened without her.
Yeah, and
I mean,
that's,
it takes one person,
right,
who has enormous,
right,
and that's what happens with Google groups and any kind of group.
Right.
And same thing would happen,
right,
with eBay and the eBay communities. You need that.
So I think you're absolutely right to point to scale, too, which is to say almost everything important that happens with groups on the network actually happens in an undemocratic way. There's the phrase democracy and the internet have been so linked in such kind of trivial,
yeah,
ways for so long that it's blinded us to the mechanisms by which what Art Kleiner calls the core group actually,
right,
leverages and manages the contributions of larger groups. Your first question strikes me as being the one. First of all, it's the one I'm least able to answer. I am not a lawyer, right? So what I recognize from the outside is society has a really good way of deferring to the judgment of groups in a bunch of significant ways, if those groups are corporations, right? That the amount of deference that we offer a corporation is huge relative to almost any other group. And if there were some way that lightweight self-assembling groups could take on some of that.
That's right. So you mean by a credentialed reputation,
yes,
credible within a group. It doesn't necessarily have to be a corporation per se. Can a group then have its own criteria for that? That would be asserted within the group and then...
I think they should. I mean,
and have standing.
A lot of this, really, the institution-to-institution thing is really trying to create an iterated game of prisoner's dilemma. Right. The threat of dealing with an ad hoc group is there is no second round. Right. We're playing this round for keeps.
That's right. That's
and right. So there's no bargaining. There's no commercial capture precisely because. So many of the strategies that are effective are effective precisely because they're non-institutional strategies. And I don't think that's going away. But if you were trying to create an institutional framework for groups, I think what you're trying to do is to say of those groups, this group is going to have enough longevity that you can start to bargain with or at least factor in the existence of the group as a whole. And that... So
it means persistence of the group.
Yes, persistence of the group.
Which may be a kind of institution in that sense.
That's right. And I don't know how to make...
There's some kind of coherence around a credentialed authority that defines the boundary of that group.
Yes, and I don't know how to make a coherent credentialed group without reference to something like corporate law. But again, I am not a lawyer, and I think there may be ways. David Johnson is actually working down at New York Law School.
This is the project, and Oliver Goodenough, where they're doing this thing in Vermont. This is something.
Yeah, actually, why don't you talk about it
Well, and very much interested in how you can easily form and incorporate digitally and run as a wiki and have different shareholder agreements to reflect these
right.
different perspectives.
Right.
And those reflectives, and so you may have a different kind of member. If it's an LLC, that reflect that. And I think, and David's very much involved in sort of in the invention of that and making it spontaneous, but then also persistent in some way.
Right. And that bridging that gap between spontaneous and persistent strikes me as being the hard question here. And then the related hard question is, A, what governance models that group have on day one, and B, how do you make it possible for that group to change their governance models to be a better fit if they need to? The sort of gnomic problem, as it were.
Well, just as a plug, one of the things that we're looking at here is how to create platforms for that enable. I mean, the Higgins, as you well know, is an identity layer that provides persistence. Identity is not a gamble, but then you want to have other layers on top of that.
Right, right.
You can define certain reputations, access rules, and the underpinnings of persistent groups. And so, ideally, so people should be able to do. Drag and drop
mm-hmm.
and create a group
mm-hmm.
that has a governance principle, and that could have standing in law, say
that's
in Vermont,
right,
and do it on something like a Google phone.
Yeah, I mean that's I think like the open source movement, there is a there's really a question of how much of this is technology and how much of this is legal infrastructure.
But why would you? You talk about social technologies. I mean, isn't this the next generation social technology?
It is certainly one. But I think that in many cases, what the surprise has been is that the mental model of the users is as important as what the tools do under the hood. Right. One of the great advantages of Wikipedia the day it launched is that it had the pedia suffix. Right. It wasn't just a wiki because wikis are just completely free form in terms of text creation.
Right.
But there was a shared mental model of what ought to go into an encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia has now gone well beyond that. It starts to cover current events and so forth. But in its earliest kernel, that shared mental model actually mattered. In a way, the shared mental model was necessary to take away the threat that the technology was so freeform that it wasn't going to be anything
right.
but goopy, a goopy meringue of a website. And... So, in addition to the kind of technological layering of that Higgins provides, I think there is some way
above that. Too.
Yes,
way above that. Yeah.
But above that in layer 8, where the brains are,
right,
some shared mental model of what it is we're doing when we coordinate in groups. And
what do you mean by this shared model? I mean, when you mean that the people assembling in a group, they
we're really good at understanding the difference between, you know, a club and a clique and a cabal, right? We understand what our membership in different kinds of organizations mean. But almost all of that is part of this shared mental model, right? That, you know, that there's so I teach, and I also work with some of my students outside of class, and we have very different ways of dealing with one another simply because the mental model of now we're all in a classroom, now we're all in a workroom, even though none of the physical accoutrements are different.
Do you mean like persona? Could I say different roles? Do you think? I mean,
some of it is different roles.
And there's a part of a social construct that you're able to aggregate.
Some of it's also how you defer to the institutional framing as a whole. I curse like a sailor in my private life, and I think to the best of my knowledge, I have cursed only rarely in a classroom. Right? It's rare for me to go 2.5 hours without cursing. Except when I'm teaching, and then I don't. And there is some sense of, oh, this is what this environment is like, and it's different than those other environments. That isn't, I think it's not all replicable in code. I think that at least some sense of telling the users, the purpose of this organization is to do X, and therefore you should relate to one another in that context, is a big open question.
Can I jump in at this point, or
sure.
Are we on?
Sure.
Great. Well, I think that there is something between. It seems like you're posing the world as being between institutions and not institutions. And when you're referring to the open source movement, I think it's important that you use the word movement. You're not talking about an institution, nor are you talking about a flash mob. You're talking about something in between.
Right.
And at this political moment, I actually think that, interestingly, progressive movements are back in the forefront after many decades of that kind of thinking being only on the conservative reactionary side of the political spectrum. We've forgotten what a movement means since the 60s. On a philosophical level, there's the tension between, I guess you would call the liberal point of view, which is we're all individuals isolated and we do little things like we join a flash mob and then we go home, versus a more communitarian view of our political participation in which we are not just individuals, but in some ways primarily members of groups and organizations. I think that we're starting to see a swing among progressives from a purely liberal point of view back to perhaps a more communitarian point of view. So there's a philosophical undergirding of a change in how we're viewing our political participation. And so when you talk about protest, I think the protest we have to, most of the time we have to remember is epiphenomenal to actually something else, which is a movement trying to achieve a particular set of goals. So a protest could be itself, if in terms of what you're saying, in terms of surprise, can actually just, with a coup d'etat, just kind of achieve that goal. But most of the time it doesn't, and it's usually only successful when you can build it into a long-term strategy. And for those kinds of long-term strategies, a flash mob level of commitment just won't do it because you don't have this kind of ongoing commitment. So when you're saying the problem is, how do you create a mobilized group of people but not so sterile as to be institutionalized, that's been the problem and the study of movement organizing. And I think a lot of what you're describing does map onto what's already known about movement organizing. I think what's interesting is also what you're describing also in some ways opens up new possibilities that people have never been able to look at. But so, for example, when you talk about what's things that are hard to fake, that goes in two different directions. One is that as somebody who is an organizer, one of the primary jobs you have is to gain commitment from your members and then to hold them accountable. And that very closely maps onto hard to fake in the sense that, you know, you have to get people to organize to a level where if that first protest fails, they're actually still going to continue. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if that first protest succeeds, you have to actually follow up and nail it home.
Yeah.
When you talk about non-professional, I also think that there's a big difference between a movement and an institution, and that ultimately a successful movement does face this dilemma when it decides, do we have to continue? You can't keep moving forever. Eventually you stop and you become an institution, and then you're part of the new structure that the next group has to kind of uproot. But when you're talking about some of these downsides as well, you've listed three, the surprise and diminishing returns. I would suggest that the surprise is itself has an immediate value, but that part of what you're also describing is what you might call authenticity. And for what a movement does when it's successful is find its own authentic voice. That also will link to your third downside. But but when the farm workers movement happened, they had tried to import "We Shall Overcome" from the civil rights movement. That failed because it wasn't native to that group. And so instead they came up with "Si Se Puede." Mm-hmm. And so there is that sense of, I mean, is that new? Is that surprising? I think it's more about what is really true about this group, and what that links to your third point, which is about human emotion not being is a lousy form of kind of something to mobilize around. And one of the practices that these movements go through, and especially initially, is to find their stories that tell your own personal motivation for why do you care about this thing, and then linking that to the overall values and objectives of the group. And if you fail to do that, then you'll fail to mobilize other people's stories, and you'll kind of stumble in terms of trying to actually gather those people together. So that emotional element still remains an important part of it, but it's a more disciplined emotion than simply, you know, kind of having this flash in the pan kind of a thing, which strikes because it's lucky in many ways. But if you actually want to achieve something because you've planned it ahead, then there actually are, you know, some of these practices which are kind of studied and known. But I think the interesting thing is what you've described as what happens when suddenly you have this density. Or in some ways, actually, I'm wondering what you're saying is not density, but actually what wasn't possible before is gathering people who are geographically dispersed all over the place. This is now something that wasn't possible before. The question becomes the same question has always been for movement organizers, is how do you get people who are geographically dispersed and have these very tenuous connections to each other connected and make commitments to each other and hold each other accountable to take action that is in some way measurable, and money is very measurable, but what about something like calling your senator rather than simply, how do you keep them accountable to that when everybody's dispersed all over the place?
I'm just going to ask a quick question. I wonder what your thought is about protest marches, because there is a kind of nostalgia, it seems to me, on the left for the effectiveness of that. But it seems now to be not effective, in part, I think, because it's no longer surprising, and the techniques for turning people. I mean, the Million Man March is the first march I can remember that achieved its short-term goals and accomplished almost nothing long-term. And I wonder what you think has happened to the protest march as a form of expression for movements.
Well, I think that's the problem is the lack of a linkage between a march and a movement. Again, the point of a protest is really to advance a strategic goal. Mm-hmm. And there's usually several. One is that you have to have a strategy. So what you usually do is you target a vulnerable pillar of the opposition's power base. And you turn out people to basically threaten that power base. So if you're not doing this with some consciousness of what you're trying to accomplish, but rather you've gotten caught up with the neatness of doing a march and you want to feel good about yourself. Although another purpose of a march is to galvanize and polarize your membership so that it begins to form its own identity.
Mm-hmm.
But both of those are means to an end. One is to attack the opposition. The other is to strengthen your own identity. In neither case is therefore the march its own purpose, but rather it's trying to accomplish something else.
Could I just comment? I mean, having been involved in those things in college and afterwards, both civil rights and war, I mean, one of the things that really struck me, particularly the civil rights movement, is when there is a certain, you talk about commitment, I think that's really important, and there's a cost. And when you had the sit-down protests and you had things going on in the South, mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about authenticity. I mean, there was a risk of life.
Right.
And part of the genuineness of the movements that came out of that, I mean, the authenticity of those original mm-hmm. efforts. I mean, you look at the Selma, it was local. Initially, it was local.
Yep.
And very, very local. And and people put themselves at risk. And from a social signaling modeling, when you start to think about this, you say, well, is this a legitimate authentic signal? Well, there's huge costs associated with that, putting themselves at risk, kids going at risk. And I think that is very transformative, which is very different than having flash mobs or things like that and sporadic. I mean, and so I think that the commitment aspect and the cost aspect are very important.